part of the task of the photographer is to bring their awareness to the world and to bring their eye and to find that beauty that everybody else is walking past 10,000 times today. And to sort of tap viewers on the shoulder and say, you walk past this, 10,000 of you walk past this. Do you see how beautiful this is? And it doesn't matter if that's...
This photography podcast is brought to you by Frames, quarterly printed photography magazine. Here is your today's host, W. Scott Olsen, with another fascinating conversation.
Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to another podcast from Frames Magazine. My name is Scott Olsen, and today, oh my heavens, we are going to have one of the coolest conversations I think the Frames podcast has ever had, because we're talking with a guy named Jack McLean. Jack, I mean, yeah, great photographer, a lot of landscape, a lot of conservation stuff, but more than that, some really, really interesting stories about Vietnam veterans, about being a kind of mindfulness in photography, a philosophic approach. We are going to be all over the map today. And every single bit of it, you know, from what I've seen so far, is just going to be captivating and special. Jack has a master's in photography with distinction from the Royal Melbourne Institute of Technology in Melbourne, Australia. He is a former priest. He's a special forces veteran of the U.S. Special Forces, currently living in Australia with some of the most compelling storytelling that I have seen in photography for some time. Jack, welcome to the podcast. How are you today?
I'm very well, Scott. Thank you. I'm really anxious to hear the show you're talking about. I'm not sure it's me that you are, but I don't hear about that guy. So thank you. Thanks for having me on.
I got to tell you, this guy is pretty cool. You are an accomplished photographer. You know, your work is elegant and beautiful, but you know, you're coming at it in a really kind of philosophic and deep thinking way. So let's just dive in. I mean, you've got this wonderful article out there called The Virtue of the Frame, and you begin by making the definition of photography a problem. You know, what is photography? And one of the things that you say is that in your attempt to answer this, that you studied a lot of philosophy, and in specific, something called virtue ethics. So bring me up to speed here. I mean, you started photography in high school. You did the darkroom bit. How did you get to virtue ethics from there?
Well, I guess it was part of my training as a Jesuit back in the day, and had to do a philosophy degree and bumped into the work of a guy named Alistair MacIntyre, who developed this. What he was trying to do was drag Aristotle and ethics into the 21st centuries. And so he came up with this concept. And I think it's a fascinating way of looking at what's the right thing to do? What's the good? What are the goods that we seek to do? And how do we do those? And as I started looking at my own photographic practice, well, the questions of virtue ethics are, who am I? Who do I desire to become? How do I become that person? So I started thinking about those questions in terms of my photographic practice. And it's like, well, what do I want to say photographically? How do I say that? And then how do I make that photograph? You know, how do I become that kind of photographer? So I just started doing some thinking about that and looking around. And I think reflection is a big part of that. I think for us, you know, I think there's a lot that leads up to triggering a shutter. And I think there's probably a lot that goes on after that moment where we release the shutter. But do we spend some time prior to that moment and after that moment saying, okay, how did that work out? You know, how close to what I was trying to do, did I get? And what do I do different? Even if I really love the result, what do I do different to make it better next time? So that was kind of when I started looking at that. Because I think the internet is full of, if you want technique, if you want to understand the technical parts mm-hmm. of photography, there's 12 million YouTube videos that will, you know, the first time I ever did astrophotography, I was going to visit some friends in New Zealand. And all I did was I did a YouTube search for camera make and model settings, astrophotography, right? And I got some amazing astrophotography shots just from doing that. So if you want the technical, there's a lot of people doing that really well. But I think there's a lot of us that pick up a camera to scratch an itch beyond that technical stuff, and that we're trying to say other things. But do we know what it is we're trying to say? Do we know what the questions are we're trying to raise with a photograph? And I think that kind of reflection is a pathway to that.
You're bringing up an interesting dichotomy here, though, because, you know, a lot of people will look at photography and say the art is in service of whoever is being photographed. And you know, the character of my spirit and soul really is, you know, a secondary deal. There's a lot of people who say, no, I am an artist. This is an expression of deeper being. And, you know, it's not an either or. So,
no.
You know, if you can do the technical stuff, you know, how did, because you say something, you know, beautiful in this article. You say, you know, with all the different experiences that you had, I'm quoting here, you say, I'm not certain I'm any closer to answering the fundamental question of what photography is, but I think it's helped me refine my understanding of who I am behind a camera. How essential do you think it is for me to have a deep self-understanding before I raise the camera to my face?
Look, every person has a different capacity for answering that. Some mm-hmm. people can be much more reflective, can be much more honest about who they are. And for some people, those are really important questions to answer. And for others, they don't have, either they're just not at a place where they can answer that as deeply, they're not as aware. But again, I don't think any of us is perfect. It's, do you continue to push forward in that? You know, do you continue to strive mm-hmm. for the improvements and to grow and to learn? But I do think, you know, I probably got back into photography maybe, let's call it 12, 15 years ago, right? And then I started looking at digital processing, post-processing packages and so on. The one thing I've never been able to find in Darkroom, in Capture One, in any, is an interesting slider. I found that I cannot make an uninteresting photograph interesting in post-production. And that led me to kind of go, well, you know, that's about me. Am I just trying to take a picture of something that I think is cool, or am I trying to do something there? And I don't think, like, I think it's like anything else. I don't think everything has to be super serious. And sometimes you just take a picture, you know, because you want to see what it looks like, to quote Gary Winogrand, you know. And sometimes mm-hmm. there is something going on that you just need to be in that moment, take that photograph, and then figure out what it means later. But I do think it's important at some point in that whole process to say, okay, what does that mean? What was it I was attracted to there? You know, why did I make that photograph? So, yeah, I don't know if that answers your question.
No, it does, absolutely. And it's a great segue. You know, the why, you are doing some work that is important and ethically important, historically important. And this is the work with the Vietnam War veterans. And those of you that follow the Frames Facebook page, you know that last March, we published an article by Jack. It's called Corporal Mick Shave, Australian Army Vietnam War Veteran. It is part of an ongoing series that you've got. There's a lot of issues behind this particular image in the series that I want to bring up. But for people that haven't seen it, Tell us what this image is and why this series that it's a part of is coming around.
So the name of the project is Stories of the Dado Dogs. And It is a series of 50 wet plate collodion portraits of Vietnam veterans. And I've made, it's complete now. I've made these portraits in collaboration both with the Anzac Memorial here in Sydney and with the veterans themselves. And As a veteran, like I was doing my master's and I was finishing up and I did some work there. And I was a bit surprised that some of my own history as a veteran came into that. And I just became aware, like when you're a veteran, people who aren't don't always know how to talk to you. They're afraid of asking the wrong question or whatever. And I think a lot of veterans, we figure out what the safe stories are to tell, right? Like somebody asks us, what was this experience like? And you learn very quickly, okay, you might say, well, the experience was like this. And for you, that little anecdote, that story completely sums up what the experience was. But to the person who doesn't have the frame of reference, they're like, what does that have to do with anything? So you learn very quickly, what are the safe stories I can tell about this experience? And then you keep telling those stories. I wanted to break out of that a little bit because I think what's most interesting, and I think what's, in a certain way, what's most historically important is these personal anecdotal histories. And I just wanted these guys, as veterans, to have the opportunity to tell the story that they want to tell, not the story that I'm looking for, not the story that, if it's the safe story, guess what? That's fine. If it's something they haven't talked about before, that's fine too. But we just sit down. I don't like the word interview in the work that I've been doing. I just see it as a conversation. And inevitably, these conversations that we have, they'll say something and I'll be like, wow, that's, you know, what about that? And that leads us down another path. And then following those conversations, we shift gears. And immediately after the conversation, we make these wet plate portraits. And for those people, wet plate photography is not fast. It's really slow. And it from the exposure time to the creation, like if I'm cranking, if I'm really cranking, I can get 5 portraits done in an hour. So, you know,
that is fast,
everything slows down when you're doing this. And there's a lot of intentionality behind the entire project for me. So I wanted to give these guys a real voice. I wanted them to have a place where they could talk about whatever they wanted to talk about. And then I wanted us to make these portraits together. I'm not interested in taking pictures of people. I am quite interested in making photographs with people. And that's a subtle distinction, but it's an important one for me. Mm-hmm. I love, you know, I'll admit it, I cyber stalked you. I looked up some of your street work and stuff, and I have a real conflicting relationship with street photography because it's so amazing and so lovely, and it captures these very human moments, right? But at the same time, some of it, and I'm not going to put your words in this category. Some of it I feel can be very predatory, and it's that taking aspect that I get uncomfortable with. And that doesn't mean that the work's wrong. It just means that that doing it in those ways isn't for me. And again, that's a place where I hope the people that are making that kind of work are doing some kind of reflection, saying, okay, you know, am I okay with this? Is this okay? Is this just about, you know, whatever? So anyway, so back to the project, 50 portraits, 50 conversations. And as we're sitting here talking this Sunday morning, I'm installing it on Tuesday. It opens next Friday. And today, part of today will be devoted to me reclaiming my kitchen table from the the wet plate portraits that are scattered all over my apartment. So that's part of it.
We should fill people in on a couple. This is the 50th anniversary of the final withdrawal of Australian troops from Saigon. So I mean, that's why the project is coming on now. But why did you choose the wet plate collodion style? Because I mean, that's not contemporary with Vietnam. I mean, you should have gotten an Instamatic, you know, or something like that if that's what you're going to do. Yeah. So why go for a photographic process that's, you know, 150 years old and use that to commemorate Vietnam veterans?
One is, okay, I got into the wet plate scene. I had just started my master's in photography. I moved to Melbourne, started my master's. I think our classes met once, and then we went into the first of the lockdowns. You know, COVID exploded across the planet. And so, like everybody else, I watched all of YouTube during lockdown. Like, I watched every piece of content right. that's available. We all did. And one of the things I had to do for my master's was, you know, a history of photography, sort of a backdrop, a context. And the Eastman House has a series on different early photographic processes. I watched the one on wet plate, and I was like, this is fascinating. And I love the results. And so I started playing with the process at that point. I think the things that attract me to it and why do I like it for this project? One is about the permanence of the process.
Right.
I'm making these images, or we're making these images on sheets of aluminium. There, I spoke Australian. So, you know, everything about the image that we make is metal, except for the collodion and the varnish. Because the image is formed in silver and it's on an aluminium substrate. So they're going to last a long time. Another reason I like it is you got to accept the limitations of the process. You got to accept the mistakes. You got to accept that these are not technically perfect. Not every image is going to be crystal clear, that there will be, you know, quote unquote mistakes. And I think for me, as I've looked at it and as I've worked my way through it, some of my favorite images from the process, well, not just because I'm the one that made the mistakes usually, but some of the quote unquote imperfect ones are some of my favorites because I don't know. I think it's maybe the Leonard Cohen thing of, you know, both in the individual and in the stories that they've told me and in the photograph, the cracks are where the light gets in, and that the beauty can be in the imperfections. And I think that's very human. I don't think anybody, myself included, loves celebrating. You know, we don't generally put our imperfections on billboards. That's not usually our strong selling point. But I think it's part of being human. And to acknowledge that and understand that, and again, understanding what our limitations are, also is a pathway to beginning to overcome those limitations. So that's some of the things that attract me to that particular process. I also think the exposures I'm doing, I think the shortest ones I did were 1 or 2 seconds, and the longest ones were like 10 or 12 seconds. So getting somebody to sit still for that is like, people don't realize what being still actually is. And they think they're still, but they're not.
Do you have one of those head braces to hold their head straight?
I do. I have a little, yes. It's an old mic stand that I bought for $100. And I do use that. And mostly part of the reason for that, like, I don't want to spend too much time on the technical, but a couple of the lenses that I'm using are from the 1800s, and they're tacky. rock sharp, right? But the depth of field on him is literally paper thin. So I'm focusing on the lines, on the lines in somebody's irises, right? And the depth of field is so shallow that their eyes are in focus, but the tip of their nose is out of focus. Okay.
Right.
Well, and then I focus, I put the plate in the back of the camera, and then they exhale and move forward 3/4 of an inch and don't realize that they've done that. And, you know, and now it's out of focus when we make the image, and you just gotta, so you use those tricks like the headstand and you do what you can.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, it's a constraint and you live with the results.
No, say this goes back to a couple of things. I mean, you were talking about, you know, there are a handful of people in the Frames community that do wet plate collodion stuff, and so I'm mesmerized by the entire process. But you know, just like you said, you know, with street photography, you know, there are some people who are they want to be completely invisible to the process because they feel the photographer poisons the moment. Then there are other people that say, yeah, but let's own it. You know, I'm going to walk up, I'm going to introduce myself, I'm going to be, you know, fully present. In the street photography moment, you know, with the wet plate stuff, you own what we're calling imperfections. I wouldn't call them that. I'd call them attributes. But you don't say this is lesser than a 500 megapixel digital, you know, image. This is something different. But you know, one of the things that intrigues me about the wet plate approach is the fact that it is every plate is unique. Yeah, you can scan it and you know, put it on the web, but the thing itself will never, ever be duplicated. And that doesn't exist anywhere else in photography. Even if you've got a negative, you know, from a roll of film, you'll hear some people say, well, how many different performances can I get out of this negative? How many different interpretations? And so, I mean, the negatives, yeah, that's the one thing, but that's not the thing we view. So there is a kind of what? Integrity or permanence was the word you used. That is part of the appeal, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I'm a little reluctant to go charging for the integrity word, but I think, well, it's just like, I think there can be a lot of integrity in any medium, you know, and there can be a lot of disingenuity in there too. But I do think there's a permanence to it. It is a very different thing. I like the, ooh, I'll get all platonic here for a second. I like the objectness of wet plate photographs, the materiality. And again, you're right. Like, I obviously, we live in the 21st century, so I need to scan these for different uses. And you show them to people digitally. And one of the things I've seen is, like, you show somebody something you're really proud of, and they're like, cool filter, bro. And you're like, oh,
yeah,
that's not what I was aiming for right there. When you hand someone the piece of metal, right, there's a coolness to the touch to the metal. There's a richness to the image. There's a resolution quality. You know, they're very tactile objects. They're really shiny and glossy because of the varnish. And if I hand it to you in the first 6 months, you know, from the time I make it, maybe 6 months or a year, the varnish even has lavender oil in it. So there's even a smell to these things.
Smell.
And
yeah.
I think there's a sensory, you know, there's a sensory dimension to these images that can be communicated. And I think that's, I'm not the enemy of digital work by any stretch. I love my digital cameras, but I do think that digital has changed the way we read photographs. It's changed the way we interact with photographs. I ran the, you know, I did the Instagram thing for a while.
I'm looking at that page right now.
Okay. I figured you might be. And, but I think one of the things I learned from Instagram was the difference between what's good and what's popular.
Oh yeah.
Right. And when I'm talking to people about that and they're like, but you know, and what I noticed, how I noticed it was like I could take an iPhone picture of a sunrise at the beach when I'm going for the swim in the morning, and it gets a bajillion likes. And then something that I think is a much richer photographic experience that I've worked on a lot more gets 50 likes. And, mm-hmm. you know, I think there's a couple of things going on there. One is in me that I need to make sure I'm not training myself for that little endorphin hit from people approving of my work. But also, you know, just because people like stuff doesn't mean it's good. You know, in the classic case of that, the analogy I use is McDonald's. Like, McDonald's has sold billions of hamburgers. But I know very few people, most of them adolescent males probably, who think that a McDonald's hamburger is the best hamburger they've ever eaten. You know, if you think the Big Mac is the epitome of burgerness, then we need to have a conversation. So I think there's a bit of that in there too. But I don't hate, but I think when we scroll past, to go back to the point, you know, when we're exposed to thousands of images, digital images at, you know, phone screen sized in a day, it changes how we interact with a photograph. And I think I'll expose my own age here. I think for many people of my generation, our first encounter with a photograph was probably in a magazine like Look or Life or Time and then we saw some photograph at scale printed on somebody's wall, and then, you know, and so I'm just afraid we lose a bit of that. Like, that's one of the reasons I love the magazine. It's tactile, and, you know, even the stock that the magazine, it's got this great feel to it, and it's mm-hmm. heavy, and it's beautifully printed. And I think it would be a real shame if we lost that from our cultural vocabulary, to be able to interact with photographs like that. So, and that's part of the reason I chose that process.
Let's take just a quick break. We hope very much that you are enjoying today's episode. The very fact that you are listening to this podcast suggests that photography means a lot to you. And if that's the case, you might want to have a look at Frames, quarterly printed photography magazine. We truly believe that excellent photography belongs on paper. Visit readframes.com to find out more about our publication. And now, back to today's conversation.
Your bit about McDonald's and likes on social media and stuff, there is confirmation bias in aesthetics as well as in journalism. So I'm going to like something, you know, that is familiar, that asks very little of me. If I say, oh, there's a sunset just like the one I saw 75 times earlier, which I sort of liked, because it asks very little from me, I can easily, you know, click on like. If it asks something more, then, you know, we're in a little bit of uncharted waters. And that's going to be ultimately, I think, a deeper and richer experience. But that also explains the difference between popularity and perhaps merit. This project is not the first time that you have dealt with veterans. There is also the It's Only the News project. Tell me about that one.
So that was a series I did as part of my master's work. And again, I got a bit surprised that I got led back there. So I was finishing up my first year of the master's program, and school had let out, and there was this report in Australia called the Brereton Report. And there are allegations of murders being committed by Australian SAS soldiers in Afghanistan during our engagement there between the Brereton, I think, report looked at allegations between 2006 and 2016. And they looked at a lot of different things. And they came back and they said, look, there's probably about 39 of these that need to be investigated as murder. And I understand, like, I love the special operations community. I'm a part of that community. I believe in the work that people in that sector do. I also don't want psychopaths part of that community. So this report was released, and like many things, you know, we were coming out of the first year of COVID. Down here, it was summer. Everybody was getting outside again. So the report was kind of a big deal for about 20 minutes in the news cycle here. And then we were on to the next thing. And I was like, wow, that went fast. So when the Brereton report was released, I immediately downloaded it and read it. And one of the things that struck me about it was how much of it was redacted. And again, I have an understanding of operational security, and we can't just splash people's names. We can't splash allegations. We need to be careful about how we, you know, what we do release and so on. I also felt like, I also do know we can say a lot about what happens in special operations, and we can, like, we don't just go out, people in those groups and in those communities don't just pick their own missions. Like, they go out and do things representative of our societies in the West, you know, representative of the United States, representative of Australia. And so it's like, okay, we need to be examining this stuff, because this is not just about some people in a particular unit that went and did a particular thing off their own back. Now, I think ultimately they need to be held responsible for the actions that they did. But yeah. So what I ended up doing with It's Only the News was I ended up taking pages from the Brereton report and overlaying those with photographs of toy soldiers that I used for another body of work about the Brereton report and wet plate. And I made these huge banners on newsprint, and that work was exhibited last year at the Shrine of Remembrance in Melbourne and took up a huge wall. But I wanted it, like, I chose 50 GSM newsprint because I wanted it to be fragile. I wanted it to sort of hang against the wall. And when people walked by it, I wanted it to blow in the breeze that they created. And if it gets ripped, it gets ripped. I think I wanted to say, well, what's our response to all of this? Doesn't matter if we're news media, if we're politicians, if we're citizens, if we're soldiers, we all have a place in this. And where do we fit in, and how do we respond? I think, you know, when I look at what went on or may have gone on, the allegations that may have gone on there, I think you have people who desperately want to do the right thing. But when you're that kind of soldier, you need to be very self-critical as well. And just because you do something doesn't make it right. You know, that's the reverse of ethics. That if I do something, that doesn't make it right. I have to say, what's the right thing to do? And then do that thing. So that was kind of the genesis of that project.
Well, what I find just real, absolutely, you know, wonderful here, you know, as you well know, you know, in the Christian tradition, that there's of a million different, you know, variations. There's two threads. You know, one is the Desert Fathers, the early monastic movement. You know, get yourself out of the world so and get rid of the noise, so you can come to a better appreciation of nature. And after you've got a better appreciation of nature, then you can move toward a better appreciation of God. There's the counter thread to that, which is no. Throw yourself fully into the world, you know, and you know, embrace the tax collectors, so to speak, and you know, take the ethical foundation that you believe in and apply it. That seems to me to be sort of the basis for how you're approaching subjects to photograph. So, I mean, would that be a fair assessment that you have an ethical understanding of your responsibility in the world, which drives your content or drives you to content?
I think that's quite fair. I think there's this old saw that every preacher only has three sermons and the rest is window dressing. And I think that's true for a lot of us as photographers as well, that there And that's why I think it's important to reflect.
It's called the exposure triangle, by the way.
Yeah, that's it. You got it. But I think a lot of us, we're looking for, we tend to come back in circles to particular themes. Like the subject matter may change, mm-hmm. but, it's that window dressing. And I think I love found beauty. And, I'm going to send you a couple of the images. I'm going to send you some of the digital things I've done. And I do believe that we're surrounded by beauty. And part of the task of the photographer is to bring their awareness to the world and to bring their eye and to find that beauty that everybody else is walking past 10,000 times today and to sort of tap viewers on the shoulder and say, you walk past this, 10,000 of you walk past this. Do you see how beautiful this is? Mm-hmm. And it doesn't matter if that's, a still life or something, a stop sign with the light on it in a particular way or a human being, there's just lots of beauty. And it's about what's the beauty you find? How do you present that beauty? What kind of photography? How do you, what's the picture you take of that? And then how do you present that to other people? I guess I want my work to help people say, I am surrounded by that beauty. And okay, so he showed me some of the beauty that he sees in and around himself. I wonder where that beauty is in my life, So hopefully it doesn't matter what the work I'm doing is. I guess I want people to question and say, do I have that? Well, maybe I have that. Because I don't think I'm anything special.
You're handing me the perfect transition to my next question here. Because you say, again, in this article, that there are two guiding principles. One is beauty, which is not, just magazine gloss. I mean, beauty is really complicated. There's this, minor branch of philosophy called aesthetics out there that hasn't been able to answer it for centuries. But there's another part. And you say, there are two fundamental guideposts for you, beauty and story. Talk to me about narrative. Mm-hmm. Talk to me about story a little bit. What do you mean?
Boy, that's...
In 25 words or less.
Okay. Oh, boy. Yeah, you got the wrong guy to interview this morning. Okay. So, look, I was thinking about this, especially in terms of photography. Why photography and not, say, mm-hmm. a moving image or so on. I think engaging someone else's imagination is really key. And I guess what I mean there is, like, I think you and I probably grew up after radio. My parents grew up during the Depression, the heyday of radio programming. And I remember as a kid hearing, like, radio mm-hmm. dramas, right? And which can be incredibly effective. Why? Because I think the human imagination can fill in the gaps. We can create in our minds visual things that are far more terrifying. if it's supposed to be scary, not showing somebody the monster in a horror film can be much more frightening than showing them. And I think when we can create work that gets people to engage their imagination, so in terms of story in a photograph, right, there's a what happened before this one instant we're seeing, and there are things that happened after. And I think what a lot of us maybe work towards is work that sort of gets people to play that sort of game of, all right, this photographer made this image in this 1/500th of a second. well, what about all that time leading up to it and what happened in those places? And sometimes we do that with a sequence of photographs. You know, I think people like Dwayne Michaels, geez, just a master of that. But it can also all happen in one frame. So I think that is a question, that story stuff. And I think how I end up, I can't remember if I wrote this in the article, but, you know, before I raise the camera, if I'm working digitally or if I'm working with, you know, a more or less portable camera, not something large format, I think that question I need to ask myself is, what am I about to make a photograph of and why is it interesting? You know, sometimes that can be very instinctive. And again, we can ask that question later. But if I can't answer that while I'm raising the camera, it may be kind of boring and just not very interesting. And it's just, you know, it is just that popular, not good. Oh, that's pretty. Okay.
Right.
You know, so I think that's where story, for me anyway, starts to enter into it. I don't think story has to be like with the Vietnam Veterans Project. There's a very explicit thing where I have just heard some very powerful stories from these veterans, right? And then we move from that into making a portrait together. And for me as the photographer in that particular context, when we're making those portraits, a lot of times I am really trying to get them to hold the stories they have told me. I want them to hold those stories within themselves when they look into the lens of the camera. And I can be very explicit about that at times where, you know, for me doing that work, the shutter is the lens cap. So I'll reach to take the lens cap off to make the exposure and I'll tell them, okay, take a breath, hold. I'll give you an example. One guy talked about walking through these villages in Vietnam and smelling French bread baking. And, you know, that was a holdover from the colonial past of Vietnam. But he said, I would just see these stacks of bread. And he said, that smell. And, you know, whenever I smell that, I'm back in that village. And so I went to make the exposure and I held the lens cap and I said, close your eyes, take a breath, look into the lens and just remember that smell of bread. And then I took the lens cap off, you know, and I just want people to hold those stories because I think when we can be very intentional about holding those stories, whichever side of the camera we're on, I think that changes what ends up in the image that we make, no matter how we make it. So, yeah. Again, don't know if that answers the story question, but there's a lot there.
No, there is. And you are hitting enough.
I think that was more than 25 words.
That's okay. You know, you're saying something here that a number of other people have said, and I don't think can be said enough. You know, the difference between the very good and the excellent, or the, you know, the excellent and the transformative, has nothing to do with technical aspects of a camera, but it has to do with the relationships that we have, which can be intimate, they can be distant, they can be, historic. But what we are photographing finally is a state of mind that is expressed by the body, expressed by architecture, whatever. And you've got to find a way, you know, however we all do it, to get that state of heart and soul to be somehow manifest in the face. That's why we can look at, you know, 1,000 pictures and say, yeah, got it. And then one comes along and we say, oh my, just brilliant work. Jack, tell me a story of an image that was particularly meaningful for you or a disaster, or I mean, just tell me a photo story.
Well, the disasters, we got lots of choices there. Let's see. I'm not going to limit myself to this project, but I'll do a couple.
Okay.
I think from this particular project, one of the things that I'm happiest with, or one of the images I was happiest with, was the Blue Mountains are just outside of Sydney, and there's a very active group of Vietnam veterans up there. And I went up there. Mm-hmm. They invited me to come up, and I spent 3 days up there. And I had sessions with three veterans on each of those 3 days, which is a lot. Like, that's wow. nine sessions. Yeah. Bang, 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 bang.
Yeah.
And they had offered me, one of them had a large property with a cabin and a shipping container that they let me use as a dark room. So I set up in the shipping container as a dark room. And I stayed in the cabin. And he was the first, that 3 days, he was the first guy that I photographed, because it was his house and everything. And he mm-hmm. had been a tracker dog handler in Vietnam. And they still have dogs, and he has a very close relationship. They have a couple of big German shepherds, and he clearly has a very close relationship with those animals, even today. And we were talking about his relationship with the dog, with Julian, was his partner in Vietnam. And his wife kind of walked through while we were having this conversation, and she set a picture of Julian down on the table between us. And I was like, "Is that Julian?" And he's like, "Yeah." And so I photographed Bob with Julian, and with this portrait of Julian. And mm-hmm. the way he's looking at the portrait, the way he is looking at the picture of his partner in Vietnam, like, there's something to that image for me. And also, from a technical aspect with wet plate, it was really hard to expose for both him and this other picture. And I got it. So it's one of those things where all the moving, you know, the planets just came into alignment, where he had told me some really lovely moving things about his relationship with these animals. And we were able to create a portrait that I felt like was reflective of that story that he had shared, and that was technically challenging, but I felt like got there. So, oh, you know, man. Every once in a while, I think we as photographers, we get that. And, you know, somebody else might say, "Well, that's a picture of a guy holding a picture of a dog." Okay, that's correct too. But uh-huh. but for me, you know, that one just worked. To somebody who's going to walk through that exhibition and see that particular picture, don't know if it'll have the same punch or not. But I'll avoid the disasters, because, like, we'd be here for weeks.
Yeah, I think we still need to have a museum of missed opportunities and bad photos.
Oh my God.
Just to keep all our egos in check. But Jack, man, I mean, we've got beauty and story and virtue ethics. We've got work here that is celebrating difficult histories. And I am a fan. I'm impressed. This has been an absolutely wonderful conversation. Thank you very much. I have enjoyed every bit of this.
Thank you, Scott. It's been great. I've been listening for quite a while, so it's really a privilege to be joining this community in this way. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Have a good morning for you. Take care.
Frames, because excellent photography belongs on paper. Visit us at www.readframes.com.